In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist, and I have co-hosts on the Long Form Podcast. They're from Long Form, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer.
Hey, guys.
Good to be back together again.
Yeah, the family rides again. Max, I understand you talked to Sean Flynn.
I did talk to Sean Flynn. Sean Flynn writes for GQ. He used to write for Esquire. He's a real master of this stuff, and we went through like the full Sean Flynn canon.
If you're looking to unleash a canon on your audience, you might want to start a newsletter through the good people at MailChimp's Tiny Letter, a simple, powerful way to keep in touch with people who care what you're doing. I think we have another sponsor this week.
We do. The Literary Reportage Department at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at NYU.
Thanks to both of our sponsors. Here is Max Linsky and Sean Flynn.
Sean, thank you for coming to Dembo, all the way from North Carolina today.
From North Carolina. Thanks for having me.
These interviews are a little tricky because there are so many stories that you've done that like I feel like I could talk to you about for hours individually. So I'm going to try and structure this intelligently and not just tire us out talking about like the perfect fire for 3 hours and then not getting to anything else. So maybe an easy place to start or a logical place to start is how you pick stories and how you think about the stories that you're going to do. And, you know, earlier this summer, you published a story about the Boston Marathon. And I guess maybe I'd like to start there. Maybe that'll help us, like help me figure out how you sort of like think about and decide, okay, this is a story I'm going to pour myself into. Right. So when did you decide that you were going to do that story? When did you decide that you wanted to tell the story of the Boston Marathon, which is how that story is described?
We decided, I say we as me and Dan Riley and some other editors, we actually decided within the hour after the bombs went off.
Really?
Yeah, I was at home and you know had the TV on. And as soon as it came on, my wife said to me, "You have to go, don't you?" I lived in Boston for almost 20 years. And that was a story that we knew was going to be big. We knew it was going to be important. We had no idea what we were going to do with it, but we thought it was important to be there as soon as possible. But we didn't know how to play the story out. You end up, you know, you already had global media there just covering the race.
Right.
And when you get those media scrums happening, they go bad often. You know, people get really pissed at reporters and they don't want to be around you. So for the first week, I didn't really get anything done. I went up there for 3-4 days. And I met some old friends, talked to some old cop buddies, and just sort of worked around the edges, and then let it sit for about a week, and then went back. And we knew then, and I actually said this explicitly in the story near the end, the media narrative in all of these things changes very, very quickly.
Right.
It goes from the victims, and it goes from everyone else to the bad guys. And that happens almost immediately. Once you have a bad guy, that's where everything goes to. So it became, by the end of that week, there was a lot of reporting about the Tsarnaevs, and everyone else sort of just got reduced to 3 dead, 250 wounded. So since it had moved on so quickly, we figured our best way to tell the story was to go back to what actually happened, and to just build from that moment of right at the finish line.
That sounds totally right to me, that it was about the bombers pretty quickly. I also feel like you spend a lot of time in that story sort of explaining the backstory behind the sort of iconic image of that day. What did you set out to find out? Like, what didn't you know? Because I feel like, I mean, it was one of those things, you know, I was also in, I was in South Africa when 9/11 happened, mm-hmm. and I just sat reading for the next 2 months, mm-hmm. you know, anything I could. And it was the same way with this. And I guess I wonder, like, what did you feel like that media scrum wasn't giving you about that scene and about the people who were on the ground? What didn't you know?
I didn't know the real visceral end of it. I did another terrorist attack story in Norway.
Right.
And that was, in some ways, a parallel to it. By the time we got to that story, all the media was about the bad guy and what actually happened on the island where the bad guy went and shot 69 people had all been sort of forgotten. It was just, there's just that one sentence. He shot 69 people on an island. Well, that sounded like something that should be explored.
Right.
And just to lay that out, because I think it is important to remember how awful these things really are, the real impact of these really horrific acts. The other important thing to memorialize in Boston, when you look at the numbers, you know, 3 dead is horrible, and 250 wounded is horrible. But by all rights, there should have been a lot more people dead. The response there was really terrific. It was in some ways kind of superhuman, that there were people. My reaction to a bomb is I run away. You know, it's and these are people who aren't trained. These weren't combat medics.
Right.
But these were people who ran towards the chaos and saved a lot of lives that day. And I thought that was important to remember.
Yeah.
And to get that all down on paper. It's exactly how this played out. And, you know, obviously we couldn't get to everybody, but we managed to find, you know, some representative people to put that story together.
Yeah, I mean, I've really been looking forward to talking to you. I'm a big fan. I'm going to do my best to not, Chris Farley out on this thing. But... you know, going back and reading your stuff, I can't really describe it as like a pleasant experience. That Boston Marathon story is a hard story to read. The Norway story is a really hard story to read. So I guess what you're saying is, like, part of the goal is to really try and put the reader there?
Yes. Those should be hard to read. And both of those were very hard to write for different reasons. Well, similar reasons, but...
Why?
Different in this. Norway got really difficult when I talked to a guy named Freddie Lee, who had one daughter killed and one daughter wounded there. And he was very explicit as to how his one daughter was killed and how the other was wounded. And it was one of those really horrifying moments when a guy is just looking at you and very calmly explaining how he's on the phone with his daughter, and he knows exactly how long he was on the phone with her for, and she's just screaming for 2 minutes and 7 seconds, and then the phone goes dead because the bad guy shot her in the head and the bullet went out the other side and blew her phone up. That is a horrifying image. By then, though, the story of Norway had just morphed into, oh, Norway has a lenient justice system. What was the bad guy thinking about? What was his manifesto about? And it was sort of, the real horror of what the guy did wasn't there. And I think it is important to record that stuff and to keep it out there so people remember that these aren't TV shows. This is real damage that real bad guys do to real people.
I feel like what I'm hearing you say is kind of like, I want to tell the... a story that is different than what the media scrum is doing, but you're still the media. Like, you're
absolutely
still a reporter, and you're still trying to go in and tell a story about something that, like, people maybe don't want to talk about.
Right.
So what's your approach? Put us there. Help us understand what that's like.
In Boston, it was very specific. I have old friends there. I have friends of friends who led me to people. And it was a lot of patience. You have to get used to feeling like a parasite, and trying to minimize that as much as possible. Jeff Bowman is a great kid. He was suddenly famous for standing in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right.
Going into his hospital, he was incredibly gracious, but going into his hospital room knowing that 1,000 other reporters are trying to get to him, and he's, waiting for the nurse. He's talking to me while a nurse is waiting to dress his burns and to redo the bandages on his legs.
Were you the first reporter that had talked to him?
I don't think so. I don't know for sure.
How'd you get in the room?
Oh, he very wisely had a media person. I believe it was a friend who happens to be a communications professional. And she stepped in very quickly, and phone calls got routed to her, and that was actually a huge relief.
Yeah.
Because, going and knocking on these doors, when you know there's been 1,500 reporters there before you.
Right, and the door is a hospital door.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, even getting into that was hard because everyone had code names, and the hospital staff was keeping everybody at bay. But in that same hospital, I talked to a person who was pretty seriously wounded, who was a friend of a friend, and that's where I got the access. But that person was didn't want to talk. Was gracious enough to tell me. That they weren't going to talk, and said that she remembered everything that happened very vividly, but that was hers. The other people can go on Oprah. The other people can talk to people. That was hers, and she wasn't going to give the bad guys that power over her. She wasn't going to let them take that away from her. She wasn't going to let them know what they'd done to her. And it was kind of powerful. And I kind of felt really shitty for even being there because
yeah.
I couldn't disagree with it. And I think I told her that I completely agreed with her. I wouldn't talk to me either. I'm always amazed that people talk to us. For the other folks who were Mike Powers and Steven Segatori and Charlie Krupa, those were friends of friends, names I'd seen someplace, and just, again, sort of gently going forward and saying, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I want to do. And just waiting for people to get back to you. And just, there's a lot of patience. It's hard not to feel like a dick. It really is.
What about those stories? Why are those the stories that you seem to be sort of gravitating towards? Those seem to be the ones that you're interested in doing. And part of the thing that comes through going back and sort of reading the last several years of your work is, it seems to me like you have a pretty clear goal, which is that you want to just tell the story of what happened in these terrible moments, whether it's Norway or Boston or the oil rig, or the Chilean mine. Like you want people to know what that moment was like, not the aftermath and not the mm-hmm. beginning. Why? Why are you drawn to those stories?
Wow. I'd never actually considered it, and I probably should.
We can come back to that. You can think of that answer.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be patient.
Yeah, no, I understand. It's, I don't think it happened intentionally. But obviously I do tend to go back to those, don't I? I guess I find it satisfying to be able to give a voice to people who sort of get lost in that. When these big, horrible things happen and the spotlight is very briefly on them and then it moves away and, it's not that I'm like dragging them out and forcing them to relive your horrible moments. It's more of a thing of if you'd like to relive your horrible moment, if you want people to know what actually happened, talk to me. I will tell your story. And I don't know why, actually, I'm drawn to those, but I guess I have been. That's a stumper.
Well, you know, I've got theories, but who cares?
I'm curious. What are your...
Well, my theory is that if you've been doing this for a really long time, there's a combination of the degree of difficulty of those stories and the purity of those stories that might be appealing. So they're really hard to do, and at the same time, they're sort of like the simplest story you can do, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's like the conflict is there and the trauma is there, and you can, all you have to do is sort of find out what happened and tell the story, because you know there's no like frills necessary. There's no, it's like point A to point B to point C, but it's a really hard story to tell.
There's definitely a big element of that. I've learned over the years that I'm not a polemicist. I'm not a pure analysis writer. I'm not a political writer. I like narratives. I like going from A to B to C. And I do like just telling a story. And I hope I'm picking the important ones.
Let's dial back a little bit. So you were involved.
You started off tough, man.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm trying to get better at this. So if you like, you can give me some advice about how
good.
To do
this. It's just like stuff I hadn't thought about. Because I don't dwell on this stuff.
How would
much.
You start this interview? What's like?
No,
it's
not a criticism.
When you do these interviews, I'm not asking for a criticism, but like when you do these interviews, where do you start? Like if I had gone through some horrible traumatic thing, how would you start talking to me? What's your first question?
That would totally depend on circumstances. It would be some small talk. Mm-hmm. I know that.
We made some small talk before.
We did
started.
Make some small talk. Yes, we did. We would ease into it. It's. I was asked that recently by somebody else, I was asked about very specific interview techniques, and I don't really have any sort of set pattern. And it's not like Morley Safer, you know, sitting down on the set of 60 Minutes here.
Right.
It's just a conversation. So I would. You know, we'd have our small talk, and I'd start to feel around the edges and see what you responded to and what you were going to be open to. And I would – so, like, Freddie. Go back to Freddie Lee, because
yeah.
That's actually a concrete example. I met Freddie outside the courthouse in Oslo. He was sitting at a sidewalk cafe with a friend of his drinking beer. And we talked for probably 2.5 hours. And he didn't tell me the specific details about his daughters until the last 3 minutes. We talked about his job. We talked about the town where he lives. We talked about his youngest daughter who wasn't on the island. We talked about all sorts of stuff. And it was just a very, you know, I bought him some beers. He bought me some beers. And we just sort of kind of hung out.
Yeah.
And then eventually you just sort of coax things out and just let it sort of evolve.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? I mean, people aren't going to tell you things if they're not comfortable with you.
Right.
So that's really the objective, is to be comfortable. And I don't think you can fake that. You know, empathy is sincere empathy is really important. I mean, people know when you're bullshitting them, and people know when you're just trying to get a quote. And, you know, fortunately, I'm genuinely curious about this stuff, and I'm genuinely empathetic about it. And it sort of... You just let it come out.
What got you started in the first place doing this kind of work?
I was homesick in college. That is, my first semester as a freshman at Ohio University. I was kind of bored, and I joined the newspaper staff there. We had a great independent daily, and I sort of stuck with it. And that was, I don't know, I was good at it. And then I didn't really do anything else. You know, I was a journalism major, but that's sort of I hate to make anyone who just blew a bunch of money at Columbia feel bad, but I didn't really learn much in journalism school, and we were supposed to have a great journalism school, but I learned a whole lot working for a student daily, and I got a job right when I graduated.
You
know,
you shouldn't feel bad. You're not the first person to come on and say, I learned a lot more doing it than I did studying
it. I graduated on a Saturday, started work on Monday, and I've just...
In Ohio?
Yeah. Small daily newspaper in Marietta, Ohio.
What were you covering?
County government, which in rural Ohio is a big deal.
Yeah.
The sheriff's department is your law enforcement, and so is courts and cops and the sewer board and the goat sale at the county fair, and, you know, it's a little bit of everything.
Right,
and
a bunch of small writing like 20 stories a week.
Yeah. That old storied beginner grunt reporter job that I don't think it even exists anymore.
At that time, were you like, what I really want to do is like sink my teeth into some longer thing?
No. Sort of. I mean, I think at that point, my dream job would have been like a Metro columnist at the Columbus Dispatch. And if that had worked out, I would have, I'm sure, taken the buyout like 15 years ago and would now be in PR.
Right.
I had a series of very happy coincidences. The paper in Marietta hired a guy from Brookline, and he his father was friends with Stephen Mindich, who owned the Boston Phoenix.
Sure.
And he was like...
R.I.P.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. I got to say, there was part of me... You're not happy to see the thing go under. There was part of me that I worked in all weeklies for a long time, and there was part of me that was just kind of like, was happy to see it not turn into like a fucking shitty,
yeah,
like listings pamphlet put out by a 12-year-old.
Yes.
It was a graceful death, kind of.
Aside probably from, the people who got canned on a Tuesday afternoon was not, I mean, it was very sudden, but yes, I'd agree.
In the
with
lifespan
you.
Of the paper.
Yeah. Yeah. It could have been.
There's also the weird, like, plastic surgery glossy years at that, yeah. But you know,
he
could have been sadder, I guess.
But I know exactly what you mean. I thought it was kind of classy. Just to, okay, it's not working. We're not going to try to fake it with. Anyway, so
yeah. So you're at the Phoenix.
So I sent some clips to the Phoenix, and I ended up moving to Boston. I sold everything I owned and moved to Boston to freelance for the Phoenix. And I did that for a few months, and I got a job there, and I've just had jobs in journalism ever since.
So you took a plunge. You didn't have the job.
Yeah.
You moved without the job.
Yeah, for a $100 a week retainer, which when I think back, I mean, that was just kind of foolish.
Seems like it worked out.
It did. It worked out.
Do you remember trying to, like, acclimate yourself to Boston?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was...
Were you just bringing the county reporter game to Boston?
I was. I was slinging it, man. It was. I mean, Boston was like a really huge city to me.
Yeah.
It was big time. So it was, and I was working for, Richard Gaines was the editor then, and I was working for Mark Jerkowitz, and I was just one of those guys who was sent out to like write about gangs and. Needle exchanges and just all the things that alt weeklies do, and it just felt really gritty and kind of cool. I liked it. I liked it a lot, and I learned a lot. And so I stayed there for I think 4 years, and then I went and got a job at Boston Magazine for about 18 months, which was just horrible. And then shifted again. I went to the Herald before the Herald went completely insane.
Something good happened at Boston Magazine, though, right?
When I went back to Boston Magazine.
Ah.
Yeah, I went back to Boston Magazine when Craig Unger was running it. And it was good then. And I learned a lot from Craig, who's Vanity Fair now, I think?
Sure, I don't know.
Yeah. Anyways, I learned a lot from Craig. And then I took another plunge. I ended up quitting that job with really nothing but one freelance story for Esquire under my belt.
Where in the chronology of that did you like expose Barnacle?
Hasn't seemed to have hurt him, has it?
He seems fine. But, you know, he's fulfilling his destiny.
You know, expose is a pretty dramatic word. I mean, it was really fish in
some
a barrel.
Some people listening might not know that story, so maybe you could just quickly
So Mike summarize. Barnicle was a Metro columnist at the Globe, and I was actually always a very big fan of his. But in the early 90s, before me, Boston Magazine started looking at some of his columns and thinking, huh, this is a little too good to be true. Let's go see if we can find these people. And the first one was about some guy who got a phone call out of the blue from a distant lover who was suddenly dying of cancer, and he packed up everything he owned and drove to New Orleans to be with his old sugar while she was dying. It was a classic noirish romantic Barnicle tale. So they sent a staff writer out to go find this guy. They couldn't find him. And that just became sort of the Barnicle watch. And it was, you know, he would recycle Mike Royko columns. He would make up the same column with just a wasn't consistent with making him up. They were all really great reads, though.
He was making up columns that he had already made up before.
Yes. And like, he told the same Christmas column, like, three times. But
it's awesome. Kept,
you know. Yeah.
It's really too bad this happened before the internet.
Well, that's actually what killed him, because early on, he had told the young guy at Boston when he couldn't find Tommy Boyle, that was the guy we were trying to find originally, Mike said, don't tell me you've checked all the usual sources. Do you have every fucking phone book in America? Well, it turns out with the internet, we do. we still couldn't find him. Anyways, it was, you know, I bear Mike Barnicle no ill will. They were kind of fun stories to write.
Did you ever did you ever run into him face to face?
No. He would never, he would only agree to talk to me, you know, conveniently like after deadline.
Right.
So it was like, you know, I can talk to you the first week in September. Well, you know, my deadline's the first week in August.
I got a bunch of columns to write between now and then.
Yeah. So I haven't made my career off of that. It was like a fun little aside.
I understand. Well, we've got some like journo nerds who listen to this thing. They deserve to hear that. All right. So you've been kind of wandering around Boston media, and then you get an assignment for Esquire. How'd that come about?
Andy Ward was a young new editor at Esquire.
Andy Ward is like one of the great through lines
Andy
of this podcast.
Yeah, he's a legend. Andy was my editor for 11 years. And when he left to go to Random House, it was like a divorce, a very amicable, heartbreaking divorce. I mean, he's still a dear friend, but it was really, really hard to lose Andy. He's brilliant. So anyways, I'm sure he comes up a lot.
Yeah, all the time.
So he was very young, and he needed writers. And he knew someone who knew someone who knew me. And he called me, and I think at the time he wanted, like, something about Whitey Bulger, which, I mean, everybody wanted something about Whitey Bulger. We spent about a year just kicking around ideas. And then there was a guy named Kerry Stainer who killed four women in Yosemite. Then he got caught. I went out and did a piece on him, which was, I mean, it was your pretty straight-up serial killer piece.
What, I mean, it was a straight-up serial killer piece, but it was, A, pretty far outside of Boston, but B, like, your first piece for a big national magazine.
Yeah.
Was it daunting? Were you, like, nervous?
I was terrified. Of course. Yeah, because it was, you only get one shot at this stuff.
Right.
I mean, you screw it up.
And
right.
you turn in a clunker on that first assignment, and there's not going to be a second one.
It's done. So, yeah, I was terrified. And I remember being a little surprised when I went out to California and you know, reported the hell out of it and came back, and a photographer was out there. And for some reason, the bad guy agreed to talk to her. She just, like, went to the county jail where he's being held and said she wanted to take his picture, and he's like, yeah, you know, talk to the jailers. And he said, yeah, sure. But she didn't want to. She didn't want to talk to the serial killer. and I remember hearing that, and I was thinking, because, you know, I'd worked at the Herald. I'd worked at Boston Magazine. Not big budget places. I remember thinking, I was so pissed that she was out in California, and the bad guy wants to talk to her, and she's not going to do it. And, man, well, Esquire sent me back there. And meanwhile, Andy's thinking, shit, will he actually go back to California to do this? So right. it was sort of a nice introduction to, you know, working someplace with some resources.
Yeah.
And having the chance to go back there and talk to the bad guy, at that point, it's like, okay, I got this.
Mm-hmm.
Andy and I just clicked really well. We put together a pretty good story.
And then the next one you did was The Perfect Fire, which is this, for anyone who has not read it, just like press pause and go read it and then come back. It is a really ambitious story.
It was. That was 2 years before 9/11.
Maybe you could just quickly give recap.
On December 3rd, 1999, there was a warehouse in Worcester, Massachusetts that caught fire. Big, cavernous, maze-like place. And six firefighters died. Two got lost, and then guys kept going to try to find them, and it's like the building was picking them off two by two. It took them 8 days to recover the bodies. And at the time, it was the worst firefighting disaster in a generation. That led the national news 8 nights in a row until they found the bodies. It was just a horrific, horrific tragedy. Everybody wanted to do the long story. Everybody. The families were getting hounded. So they sort of agreed they were going to talk to somebody. And again, that was just sort of, I knew someone who knew the right people, and that got me some entree. It took a very long time, and I remember...
Took a long time to get entree?
Yeah. Because there was a lot. You have six widows, more than a dozen kids who lost their fathers. There was a lot going on. Dealing with reporters wasn't anyone's top priority here. But Andy kept lying to David Granger, which is why I just loved him. I kept telling him, Andy, I have nothing. I haven't got anything. And then Granger would say, Andy, how's that fire story going? Oh, great, boss. Great. Going great. So he managed to buy me a whole lot of time. But then eventually I met all the families at once. And they all agreed to talk to me, like, as a group. So then it was several weeks of just going from family to family. A lot of nights hanging out in firehouses. There were some guys who never spoke to me. There were a lot of guys who spoke to me a lot. Ended up being a very ambitious story, and it was, trying to weave. It's a story with like 12 protagonists,
right?
Which was a little difficult to get them all woven together, so you didn't lose the emotional impact of it.
When you've been given the privilege by people in that position to tell their story,
yeah.
Do you feel, how much pressure do you feel to do it justice? How much are you thinking about them while you're working on the story?
Enormously. Especially because that was so much bigger than anything I'd done before. I had six families sitting on my shoulders the whole time I was writing it. Because I knew their kids were going to read this when they were old enough. I had firefighters who, sat up with me till 4 in the morning and, weeping. Mike McNamee, who was the chief in charge that night, who's still a dear friend, they put a lot of trust in me to tell their story and to tell it well.
What was their response when it came out?
Good. Good. Good sounds. Good is a strange word. They were satisfied with it. They all agreed to cooperate with the book later. Mm-hmm. Mike and I are still close. Mike and his wife Joanne. I just saw Denise Brotherton maybe a year ago, 2 years ago now. I haven't spoken to Mary Jackson in quite a while. But some of the other firefighters, I still check in with them on occasion.
When you finish a story like that, how do you present it to the people who are in the story? Do you wait for them to find it on their own?
I'm trying to remember what I did with that one. I'm pretty sure with that one, I would have made sure they all got copies.
Yeah. What do you do now? Positive.
It depends. Sometimes I make sure copies get out. Sometimes I just wait. The internet's really made that much different, though, too. I mean, it's much easier just to send a link.
Right.
And it's easier for them to find it now.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends. I have detached a lot more.
Do you sit down with people and talk it out afterwards?
No. You know, if they call me and they want to talk it out, sure. But it's, you can't be close to all those people forever.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if I could absorb that much, if that makes sense. I don't mean to be callous about it, but I sort of experienced what they've experienced vicariously, and it's hard to absorb all of that and to carry, you know. Mike and I are still friends because Mike and I are friends. We just genuinely like each other. But over, 15 years, and certainly even before that, I was covering crime at the Herald. So, I mean, there's been a lot of widows.
Right.
It starts to add up after a while.
How do you keep yourself healthy?
I play with my kids. I mean, it's I don't actually see that much.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, like I have friends who do combat stuff. Those guys are nuts. and they see
never
a lot
held
of,
any appeal for you?
No. I did one tour in a war zone, and that's enough for me. I learned pretty quickly that I'm a coward. I don't like people pointing guns at me. I don't like shit blowing up. That's not for me. But I have some very dear friends who are like addicted to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all a little bit nuts. very brave, but nuts. So I hear a lot and I have to process a lot. But there is a way to sort of mentally detach from it, because I am taking this material and trying to put it into a story. So
right.
I have to feel it. I have to internalize a lot of it. But I can let it go when I'm done with it.
Are there any that have really stuck with you?
Yeah. Certainly the fire has. There are people who've stuck with me. Some people in Norway. The widow from the oil rig. A couple of girls in Moldova. There's been... there have been an Iraqi bomb technician. There have been quite a few, actually, that I still think about with some regularity.
They just kind of, linger, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah. Just for whatever reason, I'll something will cross my mind, and I'll think about, Natalie Rochdo or Freddie Lee I don't dwell on it. I'm not sitting around morose.
I understand.
I live in North Carolina. It's I play with my kids. I cut the grass. I plant tomatoes.
I want to ask you about a couple of more stories, which are not profoundly tragic, terrible stories.
Okay.
Well, one of them is kind of tragic and terrible, but actually both of them are kind of tragic and terrible, but they're tragic and terrible in different ways. Different ways. The first one is the James Brown story.
Yeah.
Which is really like one of my all-time favorite stories.
Thank you.
And it's a little bit different than the other stuff that you've done. It's like the only kind of celebrity-ish thing you've done, although it's barely like a celebrity story. It's really about like everyone but him, kind of.
Yeah.
What was the genesis of that? Was that your idea? Was that assigned?
No.
How'd that work?
That was assigned. It was, the annual Love, Sex, and Madness issue was coming up. And there had been some discussion about the fight over James Brown's estate, which was getting a little bit of attention, not a lot. Didn't seem like that big of a deal. It was assigned as a pretty short court story. So I drove down to Aiken, South Carolina. It's a lovely little town. I went into the courthouse, introduced myself, said I was there to see the James Brown file.
When you go to a small town like that and you're like, I'm from GQ, are people like, oh shit, or are people like, gee what?
A little of both. No, I never get oh shit. I get, wow, you're here to write about the best dressed court clerks? You know, it's all here to write about the best dressed cops. It's the joke gets old.
Yeah.
I have to laugh every time too. It's just like, you got to be pleased. Yeah, please talk to me. So
can't get bent out of shape about it.
Yeah, no, it's defeats the purpose.
So you were down in the courthouse.
Yes, yeah, so I went down to the courthouse, asked you the James Brown file. And a woman pulled out a drawer of a filing cabinet and said, there it is. And I said, well, which one? But that's it, the whole thing. I was like, wow, this whole drawer? I said, yeah, there's three boxes out in the hallway too. Like, holy crap. So I started going through it, and it was just the charges and countercharges, and I started pulling names out. You know, Roosevelt Royce Johnson and LaRonda down in Houston and Cinnamon up in Vancouver. And we just said, okay, let's just dive into this one. And so we just started bouncing around. I was like, down to Atlanta, up to Cleveland, down to Houston, over to Vancouver, to New York, back to Atlanta, up to Chicago, and just, you know, one person led to another person led to another person. And it was this fascinating kaleidoscope of all these people who all had a different take on this guy.
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine you not doing one of those, like, cliche, like, police boards with, like, lines drawn between everyone.
Yeah.
And, like, how do you, when you have a story that's, like, that disparate with that many characters, how do you, like, organize it? How do you structure it?
You know, that was, we decided the most effective thing to do was first one of those, and on the opening spread, we did close to one of those police graphics. Mm-hmm. But we decided after a decent opener, we decided just to lay it all out, just to really just stack it up. This is happening, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this. Wait, there's more, which was literally the line we put in there. Wait, there's more. And just kept piling it on so that you would get really quickly how fucked up it was. You know,
right.
Utterly surreal that all of this stuff could be happening. The amount of greed and family bitterness and, yeah, it was a really bizarre. And then all the peripheral characters. I mean, everybody trying to make a buck off the guy. There was a lot of characters involved.
The other story I wanted to ask you about, which is also tragic but in a different way, is the you did like a trilogy of stories on sex tourism.
Yeah.
What was the origin there, which is distinct from what you've done but also distinct from what, like, magazines do. I mean, I can't even remember the last, like, it is a trilogy. It is,
yeah,
like a three-part, came out over successive issues, big magazine story.
Yeah.
So what's the backstory there?
Andy called me, and my first son was due in June. And he said, this is literally what he said, Jim has a project he wants you to do. You're going to travel the world, and it's going to be a three-part series. And you should do it, because once you have a kid, you're not going to want to do this stuff anymore. So you should definitely do this. I said, okay, what is it? He said, I need to know that you're going to do it before I tell you. I said, okay, I'll do it. And he said, the sex trade. I was like, oh, fuck. Because it wasn't something that was really on my radar screen.
Sex trade wasn't on your radar screen?
No, it's just it never, you know, and we started... The preliminary research was we were looking at you know, of course, we start the obvious story is the undercover sex tourist thing.
Okay, right.
Not going to do it. So then profile the sex tourist. You know, those guys don't talk. they are creepy. Didn't find them interesting at all. So we just had to look for three different places to go, and we just looked for three different ways of telling this story. I think we did all right. You know, we covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, sure.
It was a very ambitious project. That's, I mean, knock on wood here, because I've got this tremendous gig. I mean, Jim Nelson really believes in long-form journalism, and, you know, he puts out a terrific magazine, and he puts resources into this stuff. And so, yeah, there you go. That's how it came up. It was all Jim.
Was it fun?
No, not really. I did all three stories with a photographer named Lisa Carezzi. And Lisa and I kind of bonded. We got a little burnout.
Yeah.
You know, by the time you're, you know, in month number six and you're in Costa Rica for the third time and you're going to go back to another prostitute bar, it's, you know, it's getting a little old.
So you've done all these stories, man, and we got to actually talk about some of them. What was the hardest one that you did?
In terms of access or in terms of emotional toll?
Journalistically difficult was what I was, I mean, reporting, I guess, is what I was thinking. Reporting and writing, that combination. Not, we can get off like your inner tumult after publishing these things. Yeah. <you'd> like.
Well, I've actually had a really good run.
Do you think that that's luck, or do you think that's about the way that you approach this stuff? Like, a thing that you haven't said that a lot of people say that I've talked to is like, every time I finish a story, I'm like, fuck, I'm never going to find another one. This is the best one I've ever going to get.
Wow. There's
like big existential crisis after the thing finishes, which is not something you've said.
No, but because you haven't asked me about that.
Do you have big existential crisis after you finish stories?
Not existential. But I never think this is the best thing I've ever written and I'm never going to find another one. I usually think this is the worst thing I've ever written. God, I can't wait for the next one. There's got to be something else out there. You know, back to the hard to report thing. I think that what some people would think of as being hard to report, I actually see as kind of fun. I mean, I really like reporting. I don't like writing. I actually hate writing.
Really?
Yeah. Despise it, every second of it. But the reporting, I really like. I have had a great string of luck. But I like going someplace where I've never been and I have nothing and I've got to go find it. It's a lot of just, you know, knocking on doors and calling people. You know, I did a story on piracy in the Seychelles. Really hard to arrange from here.
Yeah.
So I went to the Seychelles with a cell phone number of some government minister's secretary. And when I got there, she said she couldn't help me. So, you know, Jim Nelson's just flown me to the Seychelles to do a story on piracy, and I got nothing. So I start to panic for a little while, which is a very typical, it's the same cycle. And mm-hmm. My wife talks me through it all the time. Now she just reminds me. I start to panic and then...
Call Andy and lie.
And then I calm down and I go, I talk to a lot of bartenders, a lot of doormen. I knock on a lot of doors and it always seems to work out. You know, eventually I find what I'm looking for if I just keep looking. And I don't really mind. I don't like the panic part, but I eventually get over that. You know, once I get the first step, then I stop panicking and I know it's all going to fall together eventually, somehow.
Your dad was a detective.
How do you know that?
I did my research.
That's good. Did I write that down somewhere?
Maybe.
Wow. Okay. Yes, he was.
How, it's interesting. How do you think your dad's, being a detective, your dad's work informed maybe your reporting or how you like to report?
You know, my father didn't talk a lot about his work. He was very concerned, very conscious of the difficulties a cop's kid could have. You know, I say that I grew up in Cleveland, but I actually grew up in Lakewood, Ohio, which is just, it's on the west side of Cleveland. It wasn't a big city. Everyone knew my dad was the cop. You know, like the potheads in high school knew my dad was the cop.
Right.
So he tried to keep all of that very, very separate. But at the same time, he would probably deny this, but my father has a lot of empathy. I think he was always very fair to people. And as I got older, you know, I knew some of the sort of bad guys who he'd arrested who kind of turned themselves around. I mean, he cut a lot of people breaks. And I think, again, I swear he'd deny this, but I think he had a real genuine curiosity about how people get into their situations. So I think that sort of informed, you know, not just the work. I mean, it doesn't consciously, but obviously it formed who I am.
Do you ever talk to him about what you're doing? I mean, talking about like the actual process? Does he ever give you like tips on how to sort of open doors and stuff?
He used to.
Now you don't need any tips.
Yeah, I don't really need the tips, and I'm,
sorry, it's, that it's question sort of, was insulting.
Well, no, but it, no, it's actually it's a great question, but it's I don't think he would. You know, I took a taxi out to the middle of the Atacama Desert, to go write about trap. I mean, what tip do you give someone for that? I mean, you know, you just kind of show up. But yeah, and I'll certainly call him. You know, for I used to a lot more, but I mean, it's eventually just absorb the stuff. You know, I used to ask him a lot about police procedure stuff and you know, the real nuts and bolts of things.
Do the adventures ever get like routine?
No. No, it's really, it's the best part of it. It's I've gotten to see a lot of the world, a lot of very strange places, and talk to a lot of really interesting people. No, that part never gets... I mean, once that part gets old, then it's time to go find something else to do.
I think I'm actually out of questions.
Wow, okay.
What should I have asked you that I haven't asked you?
I have no idea. I'm new to this. I'm never on this side of it.
I know. Well, how's it been to be on that side of it?
Awkward. not because of you in the least, but I've sort of realized that I haven't thought about a lot of things that maybe I should think about.
Maybe I'm just thinking about it too much.
I don't know. Those are all good questions. Yeah. I'm trying to figure out why I'm drawn to those stories. I'm going to work on that.
Yeah, I'm interested. I mean, it's funny. Like, you've actually been doing that for a long time, I guess. I was thinking sort of, I think I phrased that question as like you've been doing those more, but I guess you've kind of been doing those the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, not so. Yeah, I guess. I don't do happy stories. My mother-in-law thinks I should write about whales or cows or something. Happy.
Well, if you figure out why you're drawn to all these stories of tragedy and sadness,
I will come back and demand more studio time.
Fair game. Sean, thanks very much for coming.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Evan Ratliff and Aaron Lammer. Our editor is Lauren Kirchner, and our intern this week was Robin Jodlowski. Thanks so much to Sean Flynn for coming in. I really enjoyed talking to him. Thanks also to Tiny Letter and the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at NYU for sponsoring this week's show. We'll be back next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.